welcome to episode 202 of Radio Free Nintendo. This is Greg sitting in for Johnny, who is currently stationed in the home of the world champion, Spain. Another deserving tournament win, as I said 2 years ago. So Johnny can't join us this week. But here, as usual, James Jones.
Oh, yes.
Profoundly enthusiastic.
I am exhausted.
Can't believe you're not more excited because John is actually back.
Oh, that's kind of why I'm upset, I guess.
Well, aren't you going to Miami, John?
No.
No, they rescinded that contract offer when they realized white man can't jump.
Yeah. they couldn't pay me enough, I guess.
Salary cap concerns.
I'm stuck in Atlanta / Cleveland. But I did enjoy the 1 hour special on ESPN. That was good. It was good. It was
touching.
Yeah, Jim Gray's questions were kind of difficult to answer sometimes because they were so vague and terrible, but...
I did enjoy the fact that I had that on while we were recording last week because they were going on at the same time on mute and the closed captioning running. And I basically get an IM in our email client from John going, he's going to Atlanta. I'm like, fuck you, John. I'm working. Meanwhile, John wasn't here because he was supposedly working.
Oh, I was working. I was just doing some really boring stuff and I'm sitting there streaming it on ESPN3.
Well, and you will have already heard the voice of our special guest for this week. He of newscast fame, Neil Ronahan, senior editor these days.
Yes. I graduated being a senior in college and became a senior editor, which I guess it's an improvement.
Mm-hmm. Mm. You've been feeling the perks.
I guess.
I wouldn't go that far.
Well, I mean, if listeners to the newscast will know that Neil has been a busy boy with review copies in recent times. A lot of the main titles.
Yep,
so it's certainly apt to have him on. And this week, we're going to discuss plenty of Dragon Quest IX, which, as we record this, then Neil's review recently went up on the site.
Yep.
So we'll get straight into that. So first of all, just give us your... I know people, the newscast listeners, will sort of heard some of this already, but give us your initial sort of impressions to kick us off.
Well, I guess kind of what I said on the newscast, which if you haven't listened to that, listen to that. It's a great show. But
absolutely.
Dragon Quest IX, it's still very much like all the other Dragon Quest games, but it kind of modernizes a little bit, but without fully modernizing it. So you have stuff like, instead of random battles, you encounter enemies on the overworld. Like, the battles aren't just like the boring, like the first person view. It's like kind of cinematic as you're going around, you know, fighting enemies. It's still all turn based, but that layer makes it a lot more appealing to watch the battles as opposed to just pounding the A button, which I found myself doing a little bit in past Dragon Quest games. And then there's the whole setup with how it is with the single player. You create a character. There are no, like, defined characters that will be in your party. It's always these created characters that you make. Or you can go play multiplayer locally, and that's it, with up to three other people. And you can go, like, traipse around your world or your friend's world and either separate or meet up and fight together. You can pretty much do your own thing in your friend's world or if they come to yours.
Yeah, but when you're in someone else's world, those effects are kind of confined to that world.
Yeah. I mean, really, as far as I know, I didn't really get to test this that much. The restrictions that you have when you're in on someone else's game card is that you can't get certain treasure chests and you can't complete story missions. Other than that, you can kind of go nuts.
Right.
And I think what can happen is that, you know, the host player can call everyone to battle if they need help, or even, like, if you die in the game, then you have to wait for someone to come and revive you, but you can put out kind of like in Pokemon Mystery Dungeon, James, how we tried to do that, except for this actually works.
Yeah, that
where you can put out that call and then someone has to come and save you.
Nice. Perfected, finally. I'm sure plenty of people
have been
waiting
for that. You know, 2 or 3 years, and they're still making Pokemon Mystery Dungeons, probably the same shitty mechanic, but Dragon Quest IX did it right. And then there's all the online stuff, too, which you can't actually play anything online, but there's downloadable quests that, I think the Japanese one has been out for a little over a year, and I think they just had their last quest last week, and they come out every week, so I guess there's 52 quests to look forward to, including, if I do recall from last year, there will be a Santa Claus quest that'll come out around Christmas.
Sweet.
And then there's, like, the whole tag mode thing, but tag mode's kind of pointless in North America, at least unless you're in a major city with people who play video games and have Dragon Quest IX, because that's the whole thing. Like, with the bark mode in Nintendogs, where if you walk around and someone else has the game, then you can get a map just while you're walking past people, but that doesn't really work so much, at least in the area that I'm from, because I walk around like I'm in a car. There's not really a lot of places to walk. If I'm walking in places, there's a very small probability that a person will have a DS, let alone a DS in Dragon Quest IX.
Yeah, I mean, my plan is to pick this up and then hit the clubs.
I will pick this up and hit the clubs, a.k.a. PAX.
Yeah, the area he's referencing would be the continent of North America, where this doesn't work, essentially.
Well, I mean, I would imagine if you're in, like, a city, you might
Yeah, San Francisco, maybe, you know, one of those kinds of, you know, plenty of public transport, you know, densely populated, maybe a lot of gamer sort of demographics, you know, it could work.
I remember that there was one time I was on the subway in New York City about a month or two ago, and I was watching some person play Dragon Quest IX, the Japanese version, for about a 20-minute subway ride, so there's one person that's playing the Japanese version.
Well, that makes it even worse. Some of the real enthusiasts have already done all this.
Yeah.
It's been out for a year, I mean.
Well, so there's a couple of things that you brought up that I wanted to sort of touch on. First of all, the issue of the characters not being, you know, sort of really fleshed out or having defined your personalities and backstories and things. You have experience with playing previous Dragon Quest games on DS, do you not?
Well, I played the original on, well, when it was Dragon Warrior on an NES card, which I barely remember that. And I played, like, Dragon Quest Monsters on Game Boy Color, but I played Dragon Quest V, actually, for the review for the site, and that was pretty much the first experience when I was older with Dragon Quest. And I really liked that game. Yeah, I mean, that's my experience with it. I never played 8, although I know Johnny swears by it.
Johnny swears by a lot of things. That doesn't mean they're good. In fact, it might preclude it.
Spoken like a true Ace Combat fan.
But 5 in particular, I understand, has a really quite epic and personal kind of story at the heart of it. And so do you find the absence of that particularly sort of painful in this, or it doesn't really matter?
Not really, because, I mean, still in every Dragon Quest game, you have the really, like, the hokey translations and everything. Like, in this place, like, you literally fight things called Cruelcumbers, and there's also Meowgicians that lick themselves.
I laughed, right, because right at the start, I picked this up yesterday, and right at the start, you fight a Cruelcumber.
So at the start, you mean when you looked at the sealed box and put it on your shelf?
And there's also, I think there's a Zoom, like the Cruelcumber, kind of like the next version of the Cruelcumber is a Zoomini. And there's like
nice.
So, like, the localization for this is fucking hysterical.
It's very whimsical.
There's Brigadoom. There's a town called Coffinwell. There's a Dr. Fleming, spelt like Flem.
So, I mean, that's doing a different than like a Mario RPG translation.
Yeah. But it's like, with this stuff, it's like everyone in this town is dying. And then this, like, this one character dies, and you're like, wow, that was kind of sad. Like, that's a bummer. But his name is Dr. Fleming, so it's, how can you take this seriously? I mean, that's the thing. I guess I'm not one to really get touched by RPG stories in that way. I mean, I love Chrono Trigger and everything, and I think that's a good story there, but if the gameplay wasn't there, I wouldn't give a shit about the game. And with Dragon Quest IX, I don't think it really loses that much from having kind of more of these vignettes than an overarching story. And there is an overarching story, it's just kind of in the background. And really, I mean, the bulk of this game is played after you complete the single, like, the story mode, because of all the side quests and, like, all the unlockable classes that you come across.
Well, because it's an online RPG. Oh, wait, no, it's not.
It's a massively multiplayer local RPG.
Yeah, which is distinctly Japanese, isn't it, really?
It is akin to the local video chat that will be featured in Pokemon Black and White.
Yes.
The dumbest feature in the history of video games. Local video chat.
The story actually sounds more like a kind of Majora's Mask type story, where obviously your character is a kind of a blank slate, but you're just going around solving everyone else's problems, so it's about all the other characters rather than yours.
Yeah, that is an apt comparison, because, I mean, the premise of the game is that you're like this fallen angel. There was some earthquake that kind of messed up the world, and now you're this fallen angel. You're basically going from town to town and helping out these towns to try to get I believe it's benevolence or something.
Benevolence.
But you're trying to get that so you can, you know, get your powers back and right the world. So that's kind of the undercurrent through it. But it's more just, you're going to this town, there's a problem, you help out. Someone's probably dead. It's kind of weird because it's sad.
Yeah, it's like when people die, though, they're like, oh, I'm dead. Oh, darn.
Yeah.
Oh, shucks. What a bummer. I guess I'll have to go to the afterworld. And then you help them and they're on their way.
I'll just fight this Cruelcumber and I'll be fine.
that's super Japanese, though, to be like, yep, I died. It's time for me to go on to the next phase of existence.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, in terms of the having the non-random battles, you'll be able to see the enemies on the world map and whatnot. I mean, do you find that's made you more willing willing to explore than in the previous Dragon Quest that you've played?
Most definitely. And also with this is like, because sometimes for quests and everything that you come across, you will be looking for a specific thing that an enemy will drop. So you can basically hunt out these enemies to get, you know, find a slime and get a slime dropper. There's like other things where like, you have to defeat this enemy in that manner. So you can try, instead of, you know, going through random battle after random battle and being like, I'm just waiting for this enemy to show up, you can hunt down that enemy.
Yeah,
or
if
you know, like, oh, that enemy is a pain in the ass, I'll avoid him and go for this one.
I saw that when I first looked at my armor and stuff, it said dropped by, and I was like, interesting, because,
yeah.
I mean, most handheld RPGs don't have that kind of stuff. You can kind of farm for certain gear.
How far are you in it, John?
Right now, I played...
He's purchased it.
Right up to the opening movie kind of thing.
Oh, good God, John.
So,
do you really have to just walk into the joke?
Yeah, I knew James would have a joke about that, but you do play for a while before you actually see the opening movie.
Yeah.
But at least this is actually within the calendar month that he purchased the game.
The game has been opened within the same week as it was acquired.
Exactly. I think you are doing him... You're selling John short here, to be fair.
I think I'm definitely
being abused.
Yeah,
but John, we should totally play online. Oh, wait.
Oh, darn.
So, I mean, but that begs the question, considering that the local multiplayer is, you know, clearly from everything I've read, is tremendous fun, but not terribly accessible necessarily. How integral would you say it is to enjoying the experience overall, making it a worthwhile purchase? I mean, you're going to get your money's worth if you're playing it single player almost exclusively?
Yeah. Like, even if you're doing it single player, okay, the multiplayer is tons of fun. I mean, I didn't really get it. Like, I basically, like, found a person with the game and was like, all right, we got to try this. I got to write this review. But, I mean, even going through single player, it's like, I think the main quest, I think I put, like, 40 hours into it or something. And that was with some side quests thrown in and basically just trying to get to the end of the game. Mm-hmm. Like, there's still tons to do. Like, I'm still playing the game and I don't feel cheated at all. I feel like it's probably one of the best RPGs that I've played on DS. And there's a lot of good RPGs.
That's a compliment, certainly.
Yeah, like, it's a masterful game, even just on its own, as a single-player experience. And the multiplayer experience is kind of more superfluous, and, I mean, it's fun, but I don't think it's necessary to enjoy the game. I think it's more of kind of a bonus. Really, I hope you guys do another panel at PAX East, because this would be tons of fun if we had a couple people in the
It's the PAX East. We're just going to play this fucking game while you sit and listen panel.
Yeah. Exactly, that's our panel.
It's a good contingency plan if literally no one were to show up.
But look, that would be both in content and in attendance better than the one we did this year.
Oh, no, come on, James.
Now.
You know, I'm British and I know about self-deprecation. You've gone too far.
No, it's not self-deprecation because John and I didn't talk during the panel, so we're safe.
That's a good point.
It's more like Obi, Carl, and Johnny deprecation.
Forgive me for underestimating your ability to be a cock. So before we move on, Neil, I understand you're part of the great Jam with the Band Tea Party or whatever.
Jam with the Band Exodus from Europe.
All these copies fleeing from their budget.
I mean, pretty much. I didn't really. I got the game on, I think, Monday or Tuesday, and I didn't open it until after I wrote the Dragon Quest IX review, because I've basically been living in a Dragon Quest IX land for the week before then. But I broke open Jam with the Band, and it was a perfect complement to Dragon Quest IX, because it's a lot more relaxing, and it just seems to be kind of that, like, play what you want, almost. As far as I can tell, like, there's just the... I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, Greg, but there's just the mode where, like, you play a gig, and then you try to, you know, boost up your score, and then there's the free play. And I think there's some, like, creative aspects, too, and then you can download. Yeah. But, I mean, what I've played so far, it's a lot of fun. It kind of reminds me of, like, you know, like, Amplitude and Frequency, like those old harmonics, non-peripheral-based rhythm games, in that it just, you know, uses the D-pad and the face buttons, and, you know, if you get to the level that I haven't gotten to, the shoulder buttons, too. But it's a really cool little rhythm game, and I enjoy playing the Nintendo tracks, and it's kind of weird hearing the, obviously not the real song tracks, and or like playing, like, I'm a Slave for You with saxophone or whatever the hell it does.
It's a really, I think my personal favorite from this sort of weird marriage of instruments and song was experiencing Europe's The Final Countdown through the medium of pipe organ.
Yes,
quite surreal. I like that. There's quite some good Nintendo stuff and lots more that you could download as well.
Yeah, so do they have a lot of... Because I've tried to look at the list, but the list is so daunting that I haven't even bothered with it yet. But there's more Nintendo stuff that you can download?
No, oh, lots. Very, excellent. Very many. There's stuff from, like, Mario Galaxy, Pikmin, loads of Star Fox stuff.
But really, to me, this is what Wii Music should have been. Like, this game is really fun.
But it's on the DS. It wouldn't have worked as a title.
It's basically the exact opposite of what Wii Music was, which... I didn't really find Wii Music to be fun at all. I even went out of my way to play it, and I was just like, well, this isn't fun. And immediately with Jam with the Band, it's a lot of fun. I mean, the kind of downer is that if I ever do play it with friends, which I plan on doing soon, is that I don't think I can download that Wii channel, which is kind of a bummer.
No, you can't, because it'll be on the European shop, which you wouldn't be able to access, unfortunately. So the DS game is obviously region-free, but that aspect of it isn't for people who would be interested in importing it.
Yeah. The other weird thing that the one thing that kind of bothers me about it, although I did get used to it, is how the bar, I'm blanking on the name of the term for, like, the scale of the bar that the music is on, how it goes, like, left to right, then to the next line, and then left to the right into the next line, and that kind of messed me up at first, but it took a while to get used to.
I'm used to anticipating.
I'm used to having the scrolling notes aspect.
A continuous scroll rather than that kind of where it breaks. Yeah, I know what you mean.
You tried the karaoke mode at all?
No, I have not, no.
I went into it and I was like, nah, I can't do this. Like, it was like, we're going to vocal analyze you. And I'm like, no, you don't have to, game. I'm just going to press the button some more. I don't want to sing.
Okay, game.
I don't understand that.
Well, to be fair, that is, as you said before, though, I mean, that is the way you could just take from the game whatever you like, really. Yeah. It doesn't make any impositions on
you. As you enter the game, it kind of is like, oh, do you want to just dive in or do you want my recommendation for what you should do? And then they ask you a couple questions and they're like, well, you should go to the play mode because this would probably suit your needs for X and Y.
Yeah. I quite like that approach in terms of... there is something to be said for kind of like trying to make a structure out of a music game and fashioning a kind of journey through it in a sense. But in this case, the way it is, I think it suits it quite well to just leave everything open.
It does. I mean, how each, the karaoke mode, the play mode, and the create mode are all kind of separated. And I think that works really well for this game. And it's a pretty cool little game. I wonder if it'll ever come to North America.
It already did.
Yeah.
It's quite unusual. We're going to have I'll tease that. We've got some more bizarre stories from European localization coming up later in the show. We'll move on to John, who returns triumphant from his week off. And so would you like to fill us in on the vast amount of gaming that you've been doing in the interim?
Not really a vast amount. I mean, my main thing this week is, Dragon Quest IX. I was sucked in. I vowed not to pick it up, but Toys R Us had a sweet little deal on it where it was like they had it for $35 and you got a $15 gift card with it.
John basically said, look, I'll give you my money. So you can give me a fraction of that money back so I can come back and give you more money in the future.
Yes.
It sounds like Toys R Us and Amazon are getting in some sort of credit war over there. What's going on?
Just die. I'm sorry.
Yeah. No, I mean, I could care less about Toys R Us, but if they're giving me $15 to buy a game, all right, fine. I'll play your little game, Toys R Us. I'll play it.
That little game being Dragon Quest IX, by the way.
It's not really a little game. It's kind of a large.
It's quite big.
It's kind of huge.
Yeah, so that's the main thing with me. I'm enjoying it. Just a couple of things that Neil didn't really touch on. I was actually really impressed by, I don't know if all the battles are like this, but Neil, when you get into all the battles, are there always the kind of sweeping camera movements when you're fighting the monsters?
Yeah, I mean, pretty much it starts off when you're choosing your attacks, it'll give you that classic first person view of the lineup of the enemies, and then once you pick all your attacks and set it in motion, you can basically just kind of watch as it's very cinematic and the sweeping camera angles and everything, and your characters will move around and so will the enemies.
Yeah,
makes it a lot more pleasing to watch.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, when I was first, because I've played Dragon Quest VII, Dragon Quest VIII, and it just seems a lot more kind of fluid, the sort of play style in it. Especially battle just seems to be a lot more faster paced than it was in the past. But yeah, I mean, graphically, I think it really looks good. I mean, it's definitely one of the best games I've seen on the DS for sure.
Would it look better on the PS3, John?
Of course. Of course, if they were smart, they would have put it on the PS3. But hey, who am I? I'm just one man.
Well, they could have done both, like what they do with, was it Ni No Kuni? There's going to be a PS3 game of that as well. That could be the best looking game ever. That looks really good.
Yeah, it does.
I mean, I think it makes perfect sense that it's on the DS. for everything they typically want to do with it. I mean, they always try to keep it like kind of cartoony and sort of lighthearted and
stuff. I'm fairly certain, in fact, that more copies of Dragon Quest IX have been sold in Japan than PS3s.
I know, that's what I was just going to say.
I think we're quite safe in saying they made
absolutely. Yep.
Well, I mean, the development costs, I'm sure, were commensurate with what it would have cost to develop it on the PS3 too. So.
but it is, everything I've seen, it does look like, you know, the very, very solid production values for a handheld game. As impressive as anything I've seen.
Yeah, I was surprised, actually. It feels more like a Final Fantasy game to me than the other Dragon Quest games do. Like, the other Dragon Quest games are very...
I definitely see that.
Like, Dragon Quest VII, Dragon Quest VIII, I mean, they are very straightforward RPGs.
I mean, there is, Neil, perhaps you can speak to this, but there is the sort of the character class sort of system there, which is a little odd, isn't it? Where you kind of go back to level one and then start leveling up again all these different jobs you can kind of
do. The character class thing, like, there's a reason to do it in that you get more skill points that can then pump up your character. You can bring that back when, you know, you switch back to your other class, and a lot of the classes kind of like share attributes that you can dump skill points into. Mm. And especially as you get later on, then you can open up, like, there's 6 other classes that you can get that are basically, you know, kind of light years beyond the original 6. But those are pretty brutally long side quests to get them that can be kind of tough, and you can't really... Basically, you can't really get some of them until after you complete the game.
So is there kind of a sort of strategic cost-benefit kind of element to saying, okay, well, you know, all right, now I'll take the hit and sort of go back to level one on this class, but it'll be worth it in the long run?
Well, it's not that you go back to level one on a class. It's that, like, your main character always starts off as a minstrel, and you'll get up to, like, let's say you get up to, like, level 15 with the minstrel, and then you go back, and you're like, all right, I'm going to be a warrior, and you get the warrior up to level 8, then you can go back to the minstrel at level 15. With, you know, whatever skill points you accrued as a warrior, which, I mean, I did that quite a few times where I'd quickly take one of my characters through the early levels of a class so that way I could get, like, you know, a couple skill points that then I could pour into my character's other attributes and then kind of beef them up a little bit.
Right, so it's almost like some parallel paths of grinding, is what it sounds like to me.
Yeah, definitely.
Mm. So, I mean, does that make it feel, you know, more like a Final Fantasy game than previous Dragon Quests, as John was kind of saying?
I mean, I definitely see where John's coming from with the, like, how it's more similar to Final Fantasy games. However, I never really liked the Final Fantasy games with a lot of class systems. Like, I played Final Fantasy III on DS and kind of didn't like it. Not really looking forward to Four Heroes of Light that much, but for some reason in Dragon Quest IX, I'm kind of digging the class system in it.
Well, before we close the book on the Dragon Quest IX, I suppose perhaps people will be wondering, James, as, you know, resident RPG Don, what your thoughts on this are in terms of, you know, were you interested in it? Do you expect to play it?
Maybe, eventually.
Not terribly enthused, apparently.
I kind of liked the old-style Dragon Quest games for what they were. I mean, I accepted them as being extraordinarily old-school style games that are what they are. So I don't really need much more of that in my life, to be honest. I'm much more excited about Four Heroes of the Light because that game just seems more interesting and more kind of focused to what I like to do.
That's a sort of quite a deliberately traditional kind of RPG.
Isn't it?
It's old school.
It's a pretty hardcore traditional RPG.
Right, yeah. Whereas Dragon Quest is sort of the famously accessible kind of.
All indications are that it is excruciating, essentially.
Yeah, that's what turned me off at Four Heroes of Light, is that I read it's like, yeah, and sometimes people will leave your party with all of the equipment that you gave them.
Yes, they do that.
And I'm just like, that's kind of fucked up.
So, well, I'm trying to remember what game it was, but there was an Xbox 360 game where you could buy DLC equipment and characters would leave your party with that equipment you bought with real money.
That's harsh.
I'm trying to remember what game it was, but they would, without warning, would just leave and take this equipment that you paid real cash for with them.
That's probably a Namco game. That'd be my guess.
I think it was a US-developed game. I can't remember which one it was, though. Namco's DLC is a whole different monster. It's just scantily dressed anime women on the wings of airplanes.
Well, there is one more thing, I think, before we move on to James' new business proper. Now, John comes in, he says Dragon Quest IX is his new business, but there is a darker truth lurking behind it, because news has broken of a certain localization that's occurring.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
I think you do, John. Toaniki, the digitized graphics version,
You know
it's coming to the Western markets for the first time.
Yep.
And you are excited about this, presumably.
Camping out somewhere, even though you can... I think it's actually on PSN, right?
I assume it's there.
He's camping out at the local bathhouse, essentially.
Yeah, that's a guy from Hudson, right? That's Monkey Paw Games?
Yeah, it's Monkey Paw. He's a former president, I think, of Hudson in America, has formed this outfit that's exclusive. Looking at bringing over sort of the forbidden fruit of games.
Well,
that
Shoeniki is the premier forbidden fruit.
Hadn't quite made it out of Japan before, for whatever reason.
Skirting international law, bringing it over here, certainly.
In this particular case, for anyone, obviously, yes, there are Shoeniki games on Virtual Console, as we've covered before, but this particular one is the one that was for PS1 and Saturn, which has the ridiculous digitized graphics, and we once recorded ourselves squealing in horror.
This is the one that's way over the top, shall we say. Digitized photography.
The one for TurboGrafx that's on Virtual Console. I mean, it's weird, but you know, it's a game. It's
Well, I think it's a huge step forward for Japanese games being released in the U.S. I think. I mean,
huge step backwards for everyone else.
An idea for sort of global cultural history,
I think what's great about it is the fact that I'll be able to play. You know, I'll be able to load up my PS3 and I'll be able to, you know, load that one up, and then I'll be able to, you know, play Shoeniki on the road on my PSP. So I'm covered, man. I'm covered.
Don't you already have it on PSP?
Yeah, I do.
Yes, he bought it in line at PAX.
Yes, I did.
Because that's the kind of perverted bastard John Lennon
is. Shoeniki Zero. It's quite a misnomer.
Good
it's
Lord.
Number one in my heart.
Well, James, why don't you fill us in on your exploits in the past week?
All right, so I'm going to describe elements of a game design to you, and you tell me if this game sounds good. All right, so imagine a completely free-roaming world, 2D, where you have to go from point A to point B, which can be expansive distances, mostly on foot, where if you die, everything you've done, including the mapping of the area you're going through, because it's not mapped, is lost, and you're dropped back to the last time you saved, which could be pretty infrequently because there aren't many save points. The entirety of the map is unknown to you, and you're told to go to a point where you don't necessarily know where that is unless you've spent a lot of time just exploring the map for no reason, and then you have to wander around and find useless trinkets so you can access other parts of the map. Does this sound like a fun game?
Well, knowing that your disdain for explorative games like Metroid or whatever, I assume it's especially unpleasant for you.
It does sound an awful lot like a Metroid game, and it pretty much lays bare all the problems with the Metroid game.
See, there's a difference, but this mystery game that you're describing seems to be a shitty Metroid game.
So yeah, it's a Metroid game, exactly. So this game would be a Mega Man ZX, which basically is a lot like a Metroid game, except there's actual, like, serious, painful, disgusting difficulty involved.
So it sounds a lot like Castlevania Order of Ecclesia in that sense.
Holy crap, Order of Ecclesia is hard.
So here is how Mega Man ZX introduces itself to you. It is essentially not Mega Man Zero 1. It's somewhere like Mega Man Zero 2 to 3 in difficulty, which is a step down from 1, which was designed by Satan and all his closest friends.
Satan and Inafune.
Instead of making the game impossibly difficult, they made it staggeringly difficult, and then made the punishment for failure astronomically high.
Yes, because putting that kind of difficulty into a non-linear structure is another thing entirely, isn't it?
So essentially what happens is you get your missions, and you're assigned to them. Basically, you get to choose, and they'll tell you, this mission is in area K, this mission is in area L, or whatever. 99 times out of 100, you have not found Area K or Area L or Area whatever. And the completely worthless map, even if it has mapped that area, won't show it. So you don't even know where to warp to in the sparse number of warp points to even start to look for Area K, because they're not consecutive by letter. You would think, is it near I and J? No, it's nowhere near I and J. It's like, well, great, where is it? It's over by M. Well, fuck you, game. Why is it over by M? I don't know. So you'll wander around aimlessly. So I'm pretty much convinced when this game came out originally, no one beat it, because there were no maps online to beat it with. So what you have to do is you have to look at these maps online to beat a portable game, which itself is a problem. So you can then reach area M, and then you proceed to fight a excruciatingly difficult Mega Man level. With no continue, so when you run out of lives, your choices are load from the last save point or restart the mission. You think, oh, I'll restart the mission. They told me the mission started when I reached Area M. Fuck no, you go back to where you initially accepted the mission back in, like, Area A.
So, I mean, do you think some of this could have been cured by just putting more regular checkpoints slash save points or whatever?
Or having a map would have been spectacular. Each area has, or each combat zone. So there are areas that don't have levels staged in them, and then there are areas that do. And each one has a save point relatively close to its beginning, except for the hardest one I've encountered in the game, which is like, I don't need that. Put that somewhere else. It'll be fine. But a lot of the save points, so save points are also your warp points. You can only warp to save points, which I'm going to point out now. I played Mega Man 1. Mega Man 1 takes place at least 300 years before this game takes place. They could teleport your ass to right where they needed to put you. What happened?
So there's sort of levels couched within this kind of open structure.
Yes.
I mean, are they very similar to what you would see in previous Mega Man handheld games?
These levels would be out of the Mega Man Zero games.
Right.
Which is the problem, because these levels would be out of the Mega Man Zero games. But see, the difficulty is that when you get to a save point, it restocks your health and your lives, so you think, okay, well, I'm good to go now. But you can very often lose lives just getting to the start of the stage.
I mean, just the idea of having lives in, you know, a kind of Metroidvania type is kind of odd, isn't it?
Yeah, that just sounds...
It's a bit Zelda 2.
Yeah.
Is it kind of like having to get to your mission in Grand Theft Auto?
Yes, it's exactly like that. It's exactly what it's like. It's like, I have to get to my mission on the other side of New York.
Yep.
Only in this game, there are spikes that kill you instantly when you touch them.
Wow.
All over the place.
The worst of both worlds.
It's interesting because you're playing a lot of the Castlevania games, I do feel sometimes like the level design, because they're creating a big world, everything is a bit bland. And I almost wish some of the level designs were more like, you know, the older Castlevania games, a bit more deliberate, a bit more kind of challenging in specific areas. But I guess this is the cautionary tale about if anyone ever actually did that.
This is what happens.
Although, I'm sure they could probably do it better.
There is a stage where... So when you, as you complete missions, you unlock more missions because fuck it, that's a lot more missions. And there is a stage where the entirety, it's underwater, which is, if you played a Mega Man Zero game, underwater just means they screw with your ability to jump, so you land on spikes constantly.
Yeah, all they do is kill you slowly, in other words.
No, they kill you much quickly in these ones. It's like, oh, I died at the very start of the level because I can't control how high I jump. Awesome. Thank you, game. In this game, they didn't even bother to go with that. They just said, all right, here's the wall, here's a wall, here's a wall, here's a wall. They're all spikes. So I have, perspective, I have beaten approximately 8 mainline Mega Man games. I've beaten all of the X games. I've beaten all of the Zero games twice. And I may never beat this game because it is just too evil. But I really think this game benefits from being played on the DS IXL.
Because, oh, really?
Honestly, if I played it on the original DS, I wouldn't be able to see all the horrible, painful, killing things that wait for me.
Yeah, it's kind of essential to see them, isn't it?
Yeah, and the problem with this game is that, well, there's a lot of them, but it's so hard to get from A to B, because it's the biggest map I've ever seen in a handheld game. It is larger than Super Metroid, except it has a completely ineffectual map, and each node, so each area, can branch like three or four different ways.
Well, and it doesn't sound like, you know, because the thing about Super Metroid or Metroid Zero Mission and all that, they're quite big, but there are no warp points. And, you know, the way they kind of get around that is by the way, in a complicated fashion, it interconnects and the shortcuts and this sort of thing.
Yeah.
You know, it's a lot quicker and dirtier to just do warp points, which is what Castlevania does a lot of the time.
This is like a big branching tree from a singular node where it's like it all webs out in the different directions, and it's just, you look at the map and there's no clear indication of, okay, I see I can get from A3 to D3. There's a little line connecting them, but that line doesn't tell me anything about how in A3 I have to get to D3. Just that somewhere in A3 there is a door that takes me to D3. But in A3 there's like 16 fucking doors and death reigns around you as you walk around it. It's like, great. Awesome game. Thank you.
I think it shows the perils of trying to expand into this sort of design when you're not necessarily trying to test it at it, to be honest.
You know, it's really impressive that Capcom, like, I am such a Mega Man whore. It's ridiculous. There are Mega Man games I own 3+ ways.
Mm.
But this game has made me not want to buy another Mega Man game.
It's because they've betrayed the formula, really, isn't it?
They literally said, what can we do to make this game impossible? Let's make it so losing costs you 10+ minutes of gameplay just to get back to where the level started.
All right, well, let's move on to not so much happier, but just weirder news. We begin with last week we discussed Metroid Other M getting its date in Europe, but for some reason they decided to lag the rest of the quarter's release dates for the next week. So we just found out the rest of the stuff that's coming out over the next 3 months or so in Europe, and it's pretty barren for Wii, to be honest. There's not a lot other than Metroid, but on DS there's a couple of interesting localizations. First of all, Last Window is getting localized, which is the sequel to Hotel Dusk, essentially the follow-up. According to the press release, it doesn't connect up all that directly, or it doesn't require knowledge of the previous game, but obviously it's very much the same sort of thing, and I mean, a lot of people are fans of that game. I haven't tried Hotel Dusk myself, and maybe I'll try this one when it comes out. But of course, the intriguing thing in terms of whether this means that we'll see it in America is that last year we had the situation where this follow-up to Another Code or Trace Memory came out for Wii in Europe but didn't come out in America at all, and obviously I think there's probably more scope for this to be commercially successful on DS, but you have to wonder whether it might suffer a similar fate. Certainly if it is being localized in Europe, it could come out in America. We could just as easily said the same thing about Another Code R.
I don't see why this game wouldn't, because I can't see it costing them very much to localize.
Well, I mean, in Europe it would cost a lot more to localize because of all the languages.
More languages, yeah. So, I mean, the cost is already done, but the point is that the European localization sort of strategy has already been through this dance once, so maybe it's the same thing. Some people have kind of taken it as it's a very strong signal that it will come out in America now, and it may well do, but there's a sort of issue, a sort of cautionary note.
Yeah, any game that gets announced for Europe first should immediately be concerning. Because Europe doesn't get games first, except
Are you getting that Pikachu's Adventure? Is that happening in America?
Actually, yeah, it is.
Oh, right. Because that's already out here. And
yeah,
I know.
That was what I was going to say. Cause it's the only game we get after you is Poke Park. You know what? Australia got it before you guys, so fuck you. Explain that. How the hell did Australia get it first?
They love their Pokemon down there, man. They have kangaroos and all kinds of shit.
Nintendo forgets Australia exists for months at a time, and they're like, oh shit, we got to get these guys Poke Park.
Yeah, that makes up for everything. But, far, far more confounding than Last Window getting localized is Face Training being localized. Now, this is quite remarkable.
I have my import copy pre-ordered. This is going to be great.
Yeah, so you're already counting on Amazon heavily discounting this a few weeks after it comes out, and then a mass import of the Fashion of Jam.
Let's create the most niche title we could for a segmented market of our handheld, and then only release it.
I mean, it's truly bizarre. First of all, it's similar to the Jam in the Band situation in terms of that it's just strangely old.
Well, it can't be that old. I mean, it was for the DS.
But the point is similar to, it is years. It's not usually with localization delays, even something of the scale of Dragon Quest IX, it's like a year at most, or whatever. This is, multiple years ago that this game came out, where you're kind of using a camera thing of some peripheral to do these little facial exercises, but which is supposed to be beneficial in some way that I have inscrutable to me.
I love this game. I'm sorry.
It's like Flash Focus.
No, Flash Focus is only beneficial to Nintendo in that you gave them money to play Flash Focus.
I do like the idea of Face Training possibly coming over to America for no other reason than if it sort of follows what they did with Brain Training, then it would be called Face Age, which would perhaps be putting too fine a point on it. It's like, Face Age, how old is your face?
the best part is one of the pictures they released of this game is this Japanese woman playing it with a drawing of her next to her, indicating it with little arrows that she needs to squint her eyes. It is a masterpiece of public relations in that this picture makes literally no sense. It is
Really, I mean, what's really confounding about this is that now all of a sudden the Nintendo seems to be willing to localize just about anything on DS from Japan, and yet we don't have something like Starfy, which the US has, which
we've had for almost a year now. Yes.
Yeah, which is far more logical because it's a platform game. There's not a lot of localization. It's not bizarre.
Well, it's a little bizarre.
It's a little bizarre.
It's not face training.
It's not. It's definitely not in the same universe.
What's amazing about face training, and I'm really curious about this, is the camera on the DSi is in a different place than the camera on the DSi XL. I'm curious if you have to hold the unit differently to make the camera work, because when this game came out, the XL didn't exist.
Well, yeah, because it was just using something that it was using its own dedicated thing that plugged in. So it was completely different.
Oh, it's... Yeah.
So we'll use the built-in thing if you're playing on a DSi, because
It would have to.
Again, seems like quite a considerable effort to go to release this thing.
Release fucking face training! Was the market really clamoring for face training?
I mean, this really seems like the one thing that you could absolutely bank on would never get localized, and it is. I mean, this really is cats and dogs living together, mass hysteria. I mean,
you know, for this game to have been localized, there had to have been statistics done that say people are just dying for this game.
People want to train faces.
NOE's crack market.
Like, the only people I can put the blame for this game is the Netherlands, because that is the only country I can think of be like, face training. Yes.
They can all practice wiping the frowns off their face for losing so disgracefully in the World Cup final.
This game tested through the roof in the Low Countries.
So that was incredibly odd. I thought well worth mentioning the strange things that happened with European releases. But in terms of what I've been playing this week, I've actually been playing mostly Uncharted 2, which I won't dwell on because it's, you know, everyone's talked about it plenty at this point. I've enjoyed it quite a lot. I would say it's probably a game that's been for me more impressive than it's been entertaining, which isn't to say it hasn't been entertaining, because it certainly has. It just is very, very impressive.
Have you've played the first one, right, Greg?
No, I've not. I didn't play the first one. I picked this up because actually the Platinum version, you know, the sort of discounted greatest hits version, came out the same day as Mario Galaxy. Mm-hmm. In fact, obviously Galaxy 2 took precedent, and I played
that,
got everything of that and all, and then came back to this. So getting it for a very reasonable price and all that, just thought I'd skip straight to the second one. Like I said, it's probably the most, on a technical level, it's probably the most impressive game I've ever played.
The game just looks beautiful.
It's amazing.
And in terms of the, I've only played Heavy Rain as much as the demo. Leaving that aside, in terms of the facial animations, it's so far ahead of anything I've played otherwise. I mean, it makes something like Assassin's Creed 2 look like a GameCube game, mm-hmm. in terms of how good the facial animations and acting and everything is. So it's been fun. I mean, the gameplay is very solidly done, but not the most dynamic, I wouldn't say. It doesn't change a great deal. There's some good set pieces and everything.
It's very solid.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's all impeccably done. I mean, great workmanship, and certainly the technical achievements are sort of unimpeachable. But like I said, I haven't really, like, cover-based third-person shooter is not, like, my preferred kind of game, which is why, you know, I didn't rush out and buy it when it came out, because I did have a PS3 then. But still, yeah, well worth it at this point. Although I noted with some interest, actually, just following up on something from last week, I totted up the amount of time I'd been watching cutscenes, which felt like an awful lot, and to this point in the game that I've played, which is 20 or so chapters in. And I've watched, I think, 67 minutes of cutscenes.
Beautiful. Holy crap.
And then I recalled the fact that apparently Metroid Other M's going to have more than an hour of cutscenes, and
awesome.
I thought, imagine this long with it not nearly being this good at storytelling.
Yeah.
I am concerned.
Yeah.
But other than Uncharted 2, what I've been picked up just a little bit this week, trying to get back into it, actually, but I did have a few weeks ago, before Galaxy 2, before the World Cup and all that crazy stuff got in the way, and E3 and everything, as I picked up Monster Hunter Tri, mm-hmm. and sort of, I've chipped in about just somewhere just south of 10 hours into it. You know, it's a decent amount, but hardly anything scratching the surface of what some people have probably put into it. And unfortunately, I haven't really been able to play very much of the online yet. I've not helped by the whole region restricted thing. And I've had a few things sort of fall through where I've tried to schedule something with a friend and whatnot. But yeah, I've kind of played up to the point where I'm doing like 3-star quests on the one player and stuff like that. So it's some of the game. And I mean, so far, I have struggled to get into it. There's things that I like about it. I kind of like the boss rushy kind of thing. I always like the complicated sort of challenging boss fights and pattern recognition and all that sort of thing. But, you know, the interface is kind of a lot to get used to, and the whole gear grinding thing's not something I'm normally into. So
yeah.
I'm not sure how much I'm going to get back into it or not now. The sort of break was a little bit inopportune. I was wondering, Neil, have you played this?
Yeah, I got it back when it came out, and I was really into it, and then I got it right before Finals started, and since Finals started, I haven't gotten a chance to get back into it.
It's an easy game to drop, right? Like,
yeah, once you get out of it, it's so hard to get back into it.
Yeah, it really is.
So, John, yeah, I mean, John, obviously you were a big booster of this one.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, where have you sort of stood on it in the long run, kind of after you bought it?
I like it. I mean, I think it's really good, and I think the online is actually really good. I mean, it's a little bit goofy to kind of get it going because of all the, you know, I mean, they get around friend codes, but they really don't.
Yeah, sure.
They just basically make it a different code.
Yeah, and it's like, you know, you can't connect with somebody unless they're online with you. Like, you can't add them as a friend. So that kind of stuff is sort of goofy. But my only issue is, and this is kind of my issue with the whole franchise in general, is that it does, like you use the phrase gear grind, and that is exactly what it becomes, really.
Yeah.
Unless, I mean, they do kind of mix it up with the downloadable quests a little bit, but you'll find yourself killing the same monsters over and over just to get a certain
drop. Yeah, I mean, that was my only complaint with it when I was playing it, is that I just found that I was just trying to get the best gear that I could so I could beat the other monster, so I'd just be going through other quests that I've done already tons of times before to get that equipment.
But I mean, it's really well done. I mean, I think they did a really good job of it. It's just the only problem you will have is honestly whether or not you like that type of game.
So they did a really good job. They just made a type of game that's not fun, is basically what you're saying.
Yeah. Well, it's fun, but I think it definitely appeals to certain types of people.
They made a job that you have to pay to engage in, essentially.
Well, I think it's really geared towards people that will play RPGs for 200 hours, let's just say. Let's just say a Pokemon, something with Pokemon in it for 200 hours.
I didn't play it for 200 hours, and at least he didn't do the same thing over and over again, except for the fact that the floors were different because they were random.
That's well rehearsed, James.
That is why it's, I think, you know, obviously well suited to be in a portable game. Why it's been so successful in Japan as a portable game.
Yeah.
I always think, you know, those kinds of extensive experiences are kind of best done on portables. Would you recommend persisting? Do you think there's going to be a reward there?
Yeah, I mean, I think there is. I think you should at least stick with it and play with it online a little bit. It's definitely it's a lot better. It gets really boring if you just sit there by yourself.
I always feel like I want to bring myself up to some level of competency before I do that, and that could be that's where the break really hasn't helped, because
yeah.
I'm really quite woeful at it.
Yeah.
I sort of started out with using the lance, which apparently is like the hardest thing to use properly.
Oh yeah.
Oh, that's such a bitch.
I kind of walked into the buzzsaw with that one, I think.
Yeah, I mean, definitely start off with like a great sword or something like that, something that's just simpler. That, you know, where you don't have to have the timing down as much. You know, you're not fighting both the monster and the timing of your weapon swing.
Yeah, the big lag and stuff. Well, you know, I mean, like, I'm not someone that's really... I know some people are just really opposed to, like, anything with controls that isn't just immediate. You
yeah.
know, like, kind of like the ghouls and ghosts jump issue or whatever. You know, and I'm not one of those people. I can work around something if I feel like it's justified with the overall game design paradigm.
Yeah, well, the thing is with Monster Hunter is that you have to train yourself in a way, right? Like you kind of get like a competence and kind of get it like a base competence in the game, and then you can see, like, I think there is kind of like an aha time where you're like, oh, okay, so that's how this game works. All right, like, you can see, you know, if I get the lance, then I would be able to kill this monster more quickly, right? And that's where it kind of all unfolds, and you're like, you can see, if I actually do kind of refine what I'm doing, then I will see results. So, but that it takes a while, though. It's definitely not something for people that just want, like, you know, a quick hit kind of game sort of thing. Like,
yeah. Yeah. It's pretty much the exact opposite of Galaxy 2, basically.
Yeah. Yeah.
But hopefully I'll be able to get back into it sooner or later, because there's definitely things about it I like so far anyway. But we will now take a break, and when we come back, we'll be answering a whole lot of your listener mail.
Here's a quick look at the best original content at our website, now playing at NintendoWorldReport.com.
This week, Andy Gergen gives us his take on the sequel to Puzzle Quest, Puzzle Quest 2. Does it fix the issues of the original? Find out with his review, now up on the site.
Suspense.
Also, we have an interview with Jet Rocket developer Shinnen. We interviewed Manfred Linzer, they're a German company, about Jet Rocket, and find out if there's going to be a sequel, as well as what else they have up their sleeve next. They also did Art of Balance, which I think Carl liked a lot, so that's cool. Mm.
And years ago, famous for portable shooters like Iridian and Nanostray.
Yes, so good games, it said.
On the review side, we have Dragon Quest IX. Neil Ronahan,
right.
The reviewing machine, reviews it. The eagerly anticipated RPG gets the Neil treatment. He has plenty of praise for it. Does it do anything wrong? Read his review to find out. We also have a whole slate of reviews, actually. We have Wii reviews for Pearl Harbor, City Builder, and Pong Toss Pro.
Yes!
And we also have a DS review for Hello Flowers, a favorite of James Jones.
We also have an interview with Icon Games. We talk about their WiiWare title, Arcade Sports, and we, quote, dive into why certain sports were chosen and whether or not they are developing for the DSiWare and why they're working on WiiWare.
So do they answer why they have both snooker and pool as half of their sports in the game?
I don't know, Neil. You'll have to read the interview and find out. www.nintendoworldreport.com.
John is the worst site director ever, but he's a great ad man.
And to close out Now Play this week, we have a feature, the return of Extra Life.
Yes.
Neil's feature, this being number 6, Billy Hatcher and the Giant Egg, wherein Neil takes a look at the GameCube exclusive title from Yuji Naka of Sonic the Hedgehog fame. Find out what he thinks of this overlooked title. So that's it for Now Play this week. Check it all out at NintendoWorldReport.com. Welcome back to part 2 of this episode of RFN, and we're going to get into your listener mail now. Of course, all these letters were sent through to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com, and Neil, you have the first one.
Sergeant Foster writes, "Yo, what up, fellas? I've been gone on an exercise in Thailand, and I had pneumonia while I was there. I do not recommend that combination to anybody, but the worst thing was that I didn't have a way to receive new podcasts, so I'd listen to E3 to 200 all at once. But I wanted to say that the new site looks great, and I hope I can start sending in many questions as usual. Like so. What is it about hardcore Nintendo fans that makes us want old school games / gameplay? I'm 30 and grew up with video games in my household. That's my excuse. But I know a few 18 or 19-year-olds, a few, that are Nintendo fans. And they're also into old school games, and don't too much care for the PlayStation 1-era gamers. Xbox don't get down with it, and PS3ers poke but don't play. Thoughts?"
Well, we're good to have Sergeant Foster back among our number of the listeners of the show. We did have another question that's a separate issue, but sort of related, so we're going to read that one next, and John, you've got it.
All right, Jim writes, "In the wake of E3, I see a lot of people saying that Nintendo finally placated the hardcore this year, even though I hate that dichotomy of casual versus hardcore with their lineup. As a Nintendo console owner for quite some time, I can never remember a time when Nintendo was hardcore. They still seem to be making the same games they have for years, with changes, of course, but never targeting certain demographics. The Wii is for soccer moms and old people line is being spouted by the same people that called the GameCube kiddie, but that period seems to have been forgotten. So was the GameCube period quote-unquote hardcore in retrospect, and people were just unwilling to admit it at the time? Is the N64 the source of this hardcore gamer that loved Nintendo? Because the complaint then was that the lack of software on the system, and many gamers migrated to the PSX as a result. Doing what the supposed hardcore wants seems to bank a lot on nostalgia, But then Nintendo gets accused of not doing anything new, despite the Wii blank series, which is very new but very reviled in many corners. It seems that people who grew up with Nintendo want the company to follow them as their tastes in gaming change, but then accuse the company of leaving them behind.
Yeah, there's some interesting points here about sort of, you know, Nintendo's relationship with the so-called hardcore gamer, if you like. And so I have to agree, really, you know, the what is... When people refer to the quote-unquote hardcore gamers, you know, a lot of the times we're thinking about, you know, first-person shooter fans or whatever, you know, clearly, I mean, they're not necessarily the kinds of people that Nintendo have ever appealed to,
yeah,
seemingly. But I suppose really what we talk about with, you know, if people talk about this year's E3 or whatever being sort of, you know, more for the quote-unquote hardcore, is it's really sort of for the Nintendo's traditional base of supporters, which I would say does include children. I mean, I do consider that a part of Nintendo's base, you know, not necessarily because they're always explicitly targeting them, but because they're so good at making games for everyone that tends to include inexperienced players a lot better than those of a lot of companies that make them. But I was wondering, yeah, what you thought about, so, you know, was there a period, you would say, when Nintendo was really hardcore, so to speak? Neil, I'll go to you first.
I mean, I can't really think of any time. I mean, I guess you could label some of their games as hardcore, but at the same time, they've always kind of had the same, not necessarily like mantra, but they've always had the same reasoning behind all of their games. It's just, you know, making a good game. And sometimes, you know, you have a year where the holiday game is Animal Crossing. And other times you have a year where, you know, it's Galaxy and then Smash Brothers Brawl coming out right after it in the new year. Or you have this year where you have stuff like Donkey Kong Country Returns and Kirby's Epic Yarn. I wouldn't really call any of these singular games like really hardcore. Maybe they appeal to slightly different demographics, so it gives that appearance.
Yeah, I mean, it's a weird one, because it always seems to me to be referring to sometimes different things when people talk about the so-called dichotomy. Like, you know, I mean, you could argue, well, let's look at it purely in terms of how, you know, a hardcore gamer is not about what their actual tastes are in gaming, but just how long they spend playing them. And yeah. So if you're talking about someone who's like a huge Nintendo fan, and maybe that's what you mean when you say, well, this year, you know, E3 was for those people. I mean, I can kind of, I could see it from that point of view. But again, that's some of the problem with this whole construction in the discourse, is that it tends to be very reflexive. It's just like, well, we'll use it for whatever we want it to mean at a given moment. But James, what do you think? I mean, the N64 era, I think, was probably the closest that I would ever say with Nintendo, you know, in terms of how much they sort of banged on about technology and all that. It seems the closest. Do you agree with that?
No, because the N64 at its core was a party game system. I mean, it had four controllers, which was a novelty at the time, and in the end result, it had all these games that were designed for, you know, to be played as a group. I mean, granted, two of the most popular ones were shooters, but you also had about 48 Mario Party games on the N64, and you had a fair number of Mario Sports games, Mario Kart. The thing is, Nintendo never was hardcore because, I mean, they themselves are platform holders. So even if you take for a moment to exclude the games that they themselves don't make, whatever they make is complete, or whatever's out there is completely up to the third party. So if the third parties make the game a kidney system, as the GameCube is accused of being, then the third parties do that. If you take what Nintendo makes, they consistently make similar games to what they've made in the past. I think you'd be hard-pressed to identify any one game as being particularly hardcore for the era it's in. To use the term hardcore, even though it's not really the right term here, difficult and traditionalized game would probably be Kid Icarus. But that game, while exceedingly difficult and absolutely unfair in many ways, is not out of the norm for games that existed in that time period. They didn't go out and actively create something that would be like, this targets the most experienced and hardcore gamers.
Well, the one thing they did like that probably was Super Mario 2 in Japan.
They
did not localize for that reason. Basically.
Right, and even in that case, they said, okay, we're going to make a game that is exceedingly difficult, but a lot of games were exceedingly difficult. Super Mario 2.
Yeah, that was more mainstream to do something like that in Japan at that time.
Right. They've never gone out of their way to be, quote, hardcore. They essentially make what sells, and that's.
I think. Well, I agree in most. I don't think Nintendo's approach has changed as much as people say sometimes. You know, I do think they always try to appeal to a broad audience with whatever they do. A lot of the time, they just try and make things accessible, even if it is a more sort of traditional or complex game. You know, and they've done that over the generations. But I suppose the one thing I would say about the N64 era was really that it was that one time where they kind of got into, you know, the techno supremacy stuff a bit, you know, the whole build up to the system about Project Reality and Silicon graphics, and mm-hmm. we're paring it down to a dream team of developers that we, you know, there's only going to be the very best quality of software on this system.
Yeah, that's bullshit.
That's really the only time that Nintendo's ever been hardware minded. So do we count being less focused on software, more focused on hardware as hardcore?
They had that same kind of techno supremacy bullshit when they were going back and forth with the Sega on the Saturn, on the SNES and the Genesis. I mean, they were full of bullshit like that. Like, this is the FX chip in Star Fox. It will blow games out of the water.
Well, at least that did something.
Well, yeah, it made your games look like flat surfaces with angles on them. I mean, it's...
No, I think you're right. I mean, I think they did. They were doing that in the run-up to the N64 era. I mean, that's kind of... Well, I think the N64 approach was kind of born out of that.
I think they just do it even there. I don't think it's got anything to do with their personal strategy. I think it's more because that is what prevailing discussions at that time were about.
Because gaming was smaller back then.
Well, the thing is, in terms of Nintendo being hardcore, I mean, I think you're absolutely right in saying that, you know, Nintendo has really never changed its approach. But the thing is, what started to happen, this sort of started happening, I don't know if I could really pinpoint it to the N64, but definitely with the GameCube, they started going away from some key genres that really appeal to the hardcore crowd. They've never been strong, going all the way back to the SNES, they've never been strong in sports arena. They were on the NES.
I mean, outside of Mario sports games and, I guess, the King Griffey Jr. series.
Yeah, like the SNES was pretty awful for sports games.
Yeah, I mean, that was a big advantage for Sega, yeah, yep. in the West, wasn't it?
And they've never made sports games, like the PS2, if you were a sports gamer, you had to have a PS2, pretty much, because everybody had one and everybody was playing sports on it.
Well, I mean, if you were really, really into sports games the last generation, you bought an Xbox because you could play it online. So really, I mean, Microsoft owned that domain in the last generation, even though it didn't really bear out in their sales numbers. But if that was all you had to do was go watch people who went in and pre-ordered these games. They'd pre-ordered on the Xbox first because that was the platform to play those on. And in fact, the same thing happened with the Dreamcast, where if you were big in sports games, you bought them on the Dreamcast because A, it was online, and B, you had access to the 2K series, which was infinitely superior in most...
But I think that's the thing, though. When you look at some of these issues that have kind of changed over the years with Nintendo, it seems to have been more about, you know, how they've kind of marketed the system or how they maybe have developed the hardware. But I think that the software development kind of priorities have been relatively constant.
Yeah, well, to me, it's really been the breadth of software for the consoles. There hasn't been probably since the NES. I mean, there really hasn't been, I don't think really across the industry, there's been that one console that has had every single game you've wanted to play on it. And so I think Sony has kind of like went one direction, whereas Nintendo has gone their own direction. And both directions are fine, you know, but the one that Nintendo chose and the kind of games that Nintendo makes, what's in their ballpark, just happens to not look, it's not a sports game. It's not a first person shooter. It's not something that is heavily using online play, all of that kind of stuff that appeals to the more adult sort of audience, maybe not as general audience. They haven't embraced that. They haven't jumped on those bandwagons that everybody wants them to jump on. So therefore, people are like, whatever. They make games for kids. Well, no, they don't. They just don't make those types of games. Or they don't push them on their consoles.
See, I still think that really the argument doesn't come from what they do. It comes from what everybody else does.
Yeah.
It's essentially the perspective has changed when really it's not they haven't changed so much as it is that everybody else kind of changed around. I mean, in terms of companies, they are devotedly conservative. Even taking out the Wii. But I mean, the Wii itself is somewhat of a conservative gesture because it was, how can we make a game without spending a lot of money, essentially?
Yeah, well, it was fiscally conservative, certainly.
There was certainly a lot of risk in it, but at the same time, they had an unsustainable business path of trying to keep up with the other two manufacturers despite being a considerably smaller company. I mean, there was a certain amount of risk that came in continuing the same development path they had been on.
Yeah, I mean, they don't. The point is, they don't have the cross-subsidy potential of Sony and Microsoft to absorb huge hardware losses in an early part of a generation.
Mm-hmm.
So I suppose that the funny thing really is just that, you know, what Nintendo was making, you know, on GameCube, that, you know, perhaps in the past might have been considered sort of kiddie, now sort of gets swept up in a different category, which sometimes is named hardcore, because, you know, it's like, well, some people, you know, who may only play like shooters or whatever might consider a Mario game kiddie. But now Mario is hardcore because relative to stuff like Wii Sports or Wii Fit, it is a traditional video game that can be beaten, so to speak, which is, of course, something that hasn't changed about Mario over the generations. But even in the case of the expanded audience games, while they do obviously represent a new direction for Nintendo that's changed the whole industry, fundamentally they're very much in line with the philosophy of game development that Nintendo brought to the industry when they first came in. So I do agree with the premise of the question that Nintendo's approach hasn't changed as much as some people seem to think. Now, if we go back to what Sergeant Foster was raising in his question, the idea of Nintendo fans sort of craving, you know, the most traditional of games, so, you know, like maybe, you know, the old side-scrollers or all that kind of thing. So I suppose the issue is, if you are someone who grew up with those kinds of games, obviously, I guess it's natural that you kind of want to keep playing them, right? But it's interesting, the idea that, yes, there are people out there who still might prefer this kind of game, you know, the more straightforward kind of game, you know, that doesn't require dual analog control, but, you know, it's challenging and stuff. And I think that's really what they're kind of tapping into with stuff like Donkey Kong Country Returns at this point, isn't it? You know, that just because, yes, obviously, most of the people perhaps that you might immediately think would like to play that kind of game is because they played it when they were young. It's still a kind of game that people, you know, just as a matter of taste, might prefer now, even if they don't have that history for it, because it's just a different kind of experience.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, even going from someone like, I mean, he said 18 and 19 year olds in his email, and I'm 22, so I'm just a little above that group. But I know, you know, there's a lot of people that, even those 18 and 19 year olds, when they were little, like, Donkey Kong Country was still a thing. Like, they were just a lot younger than other people who experienced it. I mean, it's like, that would be like, I mean, like, saying that 18 and 19 year olds, you know, they don't have that nostalgia for, like, you know, Donkey Kong Country would be like, well, then why do we have it for Super Mario Brothers?
Because John was 32 when that game came out.
And John for Commodore 64.
And Atari 2600, let's not lie.
I think the point is, with the 18 to 19 bracket, is that, yeah, I mean, they would have been young enough or old enough to play games when something like Donkey Kong was kicking about or whatever, but at the same time, they wouldn't have played, like, that 2D old-school kind of game for, you know, 6 or 7 years across two console generations like older people would have done.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, they wouldn't have got kind of entrenched or set in their ways about playing that kind of game before we got to the PSX, N64, you know, 3D generation. So I think that's the difference there. It's not so much about nostalgia for a specific game, but getting kind of indoctrinated, if you like, into playing that kind of old school 2D action stuff. I suppose, really, I mean, it's just part of the kind of maturation, to me, of the industry. The idea that, yeah, you know, I mean, people, even if they don't have to have just been sort of brainwashed as children to enjoy this kind of game, this is a valid kind of game that just happens to be different from, you know, the more modern kind.
Yeah, well, I mean, 3D kind of did, for a while there, people were like, ah, you know, 2D is old, you don't have to do 2D games anymore, they're going to go extinct. But in reality, I think actually it's kind of turned around now to the point where people are like, hey, you know, we're kind of sick of 3D games, and they're actually coming back to 2D games now just for something different, for a change of pace.
I mean, we'll see, you know, how it goes with some. It seems like Nintendo's really putting their kind of weight behind this kind of revival at this point. I mean, I saw recently, apparently, New Super Mario Bros. Wii is approaching 4 million units sold in Japan, which makes it the biggest selling console game in the past 15 years. I mean, that's how big it is, and it's got, you know, quite a lot on the kind of evergreen kind of model that we've seen with Nintendo's big titles. It's got legs left in it yet. So I mean, if they can, you know, capture any fraction of that success with some of these other titles, like with DKC Returns, or they've certainly proven it's a viable commercial model. To me, I just think, why wouldn't younger people also be able to appreciate these games? I think to say that only older people would appreciate is kind of like saying, well, these games don't have merit in them beyond nostalgia.
Yeah.
And I just profoundly reject that notion. All right, well, James, you've got the next letter.
Brendan in Urbana, Illinois writes, "Hey guys, while I was listening to episode 200, an idea occurred to me about console generations. It seems like the idea of history repeating itself is true for game systems. One of the unwritten rules, like, 3 is the magic number for first parties." That De La Soul reference was for you, John.
3, it's a magic number.
All right, you're done, John. You're done. It seems like console life cycles follow a pattern like this. 1. The underdog console with the cheaper technology revitalizes the industry and smashes the competition. And he parenthetically notes the NES, the PlayStation, the Wii, and the DS. 2. The underdog console's successor brings about a golden age with lots of incredible games and still dominates the competition. The SNES, the PS2, possibly the 3DS. The next console in this line is arrogant, loaded down with too much expensive tech, stubborn in its ways, and takes too long to adapt to the competition, and lacks a good library, the N64, the PS3. A new number one from a different company then steps up and replaces it. It doesn't work exactly, particularly with the handhelds, but what do you guys think of this pattern? Is it just a coincidence, or am I way off? Or, if it is true, why do you think that is? Also, do you think Nintendo will continue this pattern with the 3DS and their next console?
We've spoken before about some of the sort of parallels between, Nintendo and the N64 and Sony and the PS3. So it is something of a pattern. I do think complacency or arrogance, as Brendan put it, is part of the problem. That people yeah. get such a level of faith in the power of the brand that they start to do things that, in terms of market forces, don't make much sense.
Yeah, they start to think that people need their product instead of want their product.
Yeah.
I think that the difference here between the PS3 and the N64, which is two primary examples he cites, is that the N64 was actually a conservative move. It was, we're going to make what is essentially an evolution of the SNES. Whereas the PlayStation was a considerably more radical move in that we're going to essentially abandon what the format games have come on heretofore and do something else entirely.
I accept that to some extent, but I think the real area where there's a parallel with the N64 is basically the idea, look, we're sticking with cartridges, and what we're saying is, in fact, this whole Dream Team stuff, we're going to make it harder to develop for this system than it was for the Super Famicom. We're not interested in having, the widest possible slate of developers making games for our console, because, we basically want to say, oh, the games are higher quality, it's going to be more exclusive, and that this was a position they could take because they were Nintendo, because they owned the Japanese market in the period of the NES and Super NES, even more so than they did America and Europe. So they thought they could get away with this. Now, with Sony and the PS3, it's not so much to do with the fact that they wanted to make the PS3 harder to develop for, because
they did, but that's not what they did. That's not their reasoning.
Yeah, they were doing other things with the tech, though.
But yeah, they put Blu-ray in it and some of the other things they did.
They also wanted companies to adopt Cell for various reasons as well.
Yeah, so in this case, the motivations were slightly different, but the bottom line is they were doing things they thought they could get away with because of who they had become in the previous two cycles.
But see, I think in the case of Nintendo, though, the Dream Team argument was almost like, at this point, like, oh shit, we're in trouble, if that makes sense.
But
like,
I mean, Yamauchi has pretty much conceded this point, that his vision was of creating, a more exclusive environment.
But he's insane. I mean, that's...
He basically had to own up to the fact that, yes, that's what he envisioned, and it was a massive mistake.
Yeah, that sounds a whole lot like Sony when... Who was it that said that, oh, people will have to save up for 2 months and they'll like it?
That was Kaz. That was good old Kaz.
Another classic, but that's a classic arrogance. It's that same type of arrogance where, you know what? Well, if you don't like it, that's just... it's like, if you don't like it, that's too bad.
That's a different kind of arrogance, though. That's not arrogance against your... in the industry. That's arrogance against your consumer.
Yeah.
I think that kind of arrogance pisses people off a lot.
Well, of course, but that particular brand, that complacency is what John says. It's like the idea, well, they need us.
Yeah.
So what are they going to do?
I think part of the problem with the N64 was just ignorance. They felt like, well, there's no way the cartridge could end badly, except it had every possible disadvantage one could imagine, except fast load times. I think it really came down to they're like, well, what's more important, load times or having substantially more space and being substantially cheaper? Like, load times. And it was just like, this is the dumbest decision you could have possibly made.
I mean, that was one case there, you know, where I think they were letting their kind of software-driven approach run a little bit too wild for the corporate objectives, you know, for the bottom line, because it was a big thing, you know, with Miyamoto when talking about creating something like Mario or Zelda on N64, that they didn't have a lot of load times, then it was as continuous as possible.
Yeah.
And I'm sure, yeah, you know, the whole cartridge and piracy and stuff played into it as well. But to some extent, they created hardware to, you know, accommodate Miyamoto's desires, and that really hurt them commercially.
And that's kind of why I have a problem comparing these two particular consoles, because Nintendo's decision was based entirely on them being a software-driven company, where they are the platform holder, but really, software is kind of what they do, and the platform is just...
And even what we're talking about with, you know, Yamauchi and making it more exclusive, that's about software.
Yeah, but whereas Sony's decision on the PS3, every last one of them, was a completely corporate platform-driven decision.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. There are significant differences.
And it wasn't even just that. It was like, we want to sell HDTVs because we make those, so we want to basically... That's why they use the phrase, we are the only fully HD console maker out there. And they make things like, you can't really experience PS3 unless you do it on a 1080p television. Mm-hmm. And they still do it, because now they're trying to push 3D with the same system.
Yep.
Sony's biggest problem is that they are the most hard-headed company in existence not named Apple.
Yeah.
Well, and also it's because they're pretty much all the things they do on their own merits are kind of not strictly economic, because there's always the other angle. There's always like with the complementarity,
right,
with some other part of their business, or, you know, and it's I mean, look at the raw numbers, what they've done to the gaming division, you know, which was turning a very, very healthy profit in the PS2. So, and it's just, even now that they, you know, yes, they're selling more units, yes, they've reduced the cost of making the system, and they've got the slim and all that, but they have lost so much money to this point.
Yeah, I was trying to think,
it's still an unmitigated disaster.
I was thinking about that, and the only thing I can think of is that kind of winning the HD format war was so important to them that they were willing to sacrifice the games part of their company.
Yeah, well, and apparently, but, I mean, that is revealed by their behavior, I suppose.
Yeah, and that's, and I can't understand that. The funny thing about it was, just for kicks, I looked back as I was like, man, you know, I was thinking about the launch price of the PS3. Okay, it was $600. If you look back at the launch price of the PS2, it was $300. The PS2, wildly popular. One of the most popular consoles ever. And it was $300.
It is.
What meeting did they decide, hey, let's make a console twice as much as that one? That will work out somehow. Who made that decision?
But that's where you could talk about the fact that, yes, they got all these other weird hardware or, like, you know, cross-device concerns that Nintendo never had. But underpinning both strands of folly is the arrogance that Brendan talks about. And that's the big thing. Now, pivoting to the, you know, how it plays into the kind of handheld thing, I mean, I think that's what's interesting, because if you look at what had happened in the handheld space leading up to the DS, you've got, you know, Game Boy, which goes on for ages, Game Boy Color, and GBA. It would have been very easy for Nintendo to settle into that kind of complacent, arrogant kind of mindset in the portable space. But, of course, before that really had the chance to set in completely, I think the experience of what happened to them in the console market kind of shook them out of that, and that's why the DS isn't wasn't some, you know, stupid exclusionary kind of system. Even though their portable dominance was never actually overthrown, they had been so shaken by the experience that they felt they couldn't do something complacent. They did have to come to the market with something
different. I think in the portable market, they've been helped by the fact that every opponent they've had is incompetent.
Well, you know what every single opponent that they've had has done? They've tried to over-engineer their handheld that they make. They have completely they have misinterpreted what the handheld market is all about.
If you go back to, like, the Game Gear, which was a color screen when color screens were exorbitantly expensive and huge draw on the battery.
Battery
Nomad.
You carry around a giant system that has 6 batteries and costs a fortune. Oh, that's not going to work.
Yeah, I mean, they've all of these opponents, they've all thought, hey, well, we can just throw a bunch of engineering at the handheld market And because people like the console experience, wouldn't it be cool if you had the console experience on the go?
And the Lynx is the closest parallel to the PSP there was. Because like, this is a console experience on the go. I'm like, no, this is a bad experience on the go. What are you thinking?
But I think that's the point, though, is that given that record, it could have been very easy for them to settle into a sort of really quite complacent sort of attitude with their handhelds. But I think you see what happened with the PSP. You know, it kind of, they preempted it and were not complacent and they were disruptive and all that kind of stuff. They got ahead of the curve and therefore kind of broke the cycle that we've seen in the console markets. And I suppose 3DS is sort of another test of whether they're going to continue to learn the lessons to some extent, because it might be, you know, at this point, as we've said, you know, once again, they've asserted their dominance completely. So it might be tempting to kind of slide into that again. And, you know, we are seeing a situation where development costs are going to go up and this sort of thing. So, you know, maybe will be the Super NES rather than the N64, but it still could be a sort of a trajectory to one day put them back on the road to getting a bit too big for their boots. So I'll be interested to see if there's a sort of an expiration date on these lessons that get learned. All right, well, I think we will now move on to the next question. This is in from Tween20 in Connecticut, and he writes, "Hello, guys. I loved episode 200. I was late to the DS party, and I've only had my DS Lite for a little over 3 years, so hearing the history of the DS was very interesting. Your conversation about how much better the DS Lite was than the original DS did raise a question. Is the 3DS a first-day purchase for you, or are you concerned that, like the DS/DS Lite, the second iteration will be so much better that it would be best to wait? I am so excited about the potential of 3DS, but given that the cost of 3DS is likely to be quite high, the idea of shelling out for the quote-unquote better version 6 months to a year later after the original does not thrill me." Well, it's quite a natural sort of question. So, Neil, what are your thoughts on this? Obviously, you bit on the DSi.
Yeah, and I still love the DSi. But the one thing that I think with the 3DS is I don't think, or at least just from what I've seen, I don't think we're going to see a second iteration as quickly as we did with the DS Lite. I feel like they've had time to sit on the 3DS for a while. I mean, as far as we know, I think it's, you know, it's been in the works for quite a while, and they're set on the form factor for, you know, what's going to come out either this fall or next year, well, before March 31st, 2011.
Yeah, the fiscal,
they're pretty set on what that's going to look like, and I think also because it's not that big of a departure from the DS, they kind of have that basic technology down to a science, pretty much. I mean, you guys were talking about in episode 200 about how the DS Lite is probably, like, the best engineered system ever, and the 3DS is based on that, and it's going to be less of those superfluous additions that the DSi had. I mean, part of the reason why I got a DSi is because I was rocking a DS Fat for all that time, and I was like, well, downloadable games will get me to buy a new one, finally. Because the DSi is basically just, you know, a incremental evolution of a DS Lite, and I think the 3DS is kind of a larger step in the evolution of the DS Lite.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, in terms of the system itself, it's, you know, it's this massive leap, but in terms of the form factor and things like that, you know, it's very much retaining the same thing. You know, it's like, why kill a good thing? You know, I mean, they seem, you know, demonstrates how happy they are with what the DS Lite set, you know, that precedent, which is really working for them. So, yeah, I don't expect anything that radical. I suppose the point is, it may be the case. You know, there might be some weird little thing about 3DS that everyone kind of finds annoying or something, but when we get to it, that ends up getting revised. But I certainly don't expect, I mean, I do expect revisions because
naturally, but I don't think it's going to be as much of a game changer as the DS Lite was.
Exactly, it's not the kind of thing that you're going to be kicking yourself for not getting in on early. I mean, really, I mean, the question's going to be, you know, when we actually see exactly the kind of software that's going to be launching early on with 3DS, is like, can you, you know, are you comfortable with waiting for that software or not? You know, it's probably going to be some of it, isn't it? And I mean, so far it's kind of difficult to say because a lot of the stuff was kind of a bit tech demo-y, or you're not seeing like the actual gameplay or stuff, but it does seem like they're going to have a lot more things early than they did with the DS, and that wouldn't be hard, frankly. I think the interesting point, though, is about the 3DS is the price. I wanted to bring up, because obviously says, you know, it could be quite high. I mean, when we did the E3 prediction show, I was, you know, I felt quite solid that it would, you know, be 199, basically. You know, they wouldn't want to go over 200. But, you know, as time's gone on, I'm getting less confident about that. James, I mean, what have you... being at E3 and everything, has your view changed at all on that?
I seem to recall being somewhat non-committal because I didn't know what the hell to expect of the system.
Sure, yeah. I mean, yeah. But now we know pretty much, you know, what
it
is.
I don't think 250 is beyond them because they broke that barrier with the Wii, and I feel like...
Yeah, as long as there's a Wii price drop to go along with it, I think it might work.
I feel like they have to make money on their systems, and it's not just that they have to for economic reasons. It's a cultural thing within the company.
Yeah, they've never not done that.
So they would be uncomfortable pricing the system in such a way that they do not turn a profit on it. So, unfortunately, I'm not really sure of how much those particular screens run. And that's really the biggest variable.
Well,
there.
But of course, the thing about it is that when you're pricing for the US, you have a different set of considerations to take into account than you are with
Japan.
You have
exchange rate and import stuff.
Yeah, because the point is that you can't flex the price up, really, afterwards. The only way you can do that is by releasing a new iteration. And you have to futz with feature sets and fool people that it's great that you're getting more when actually you're kind of screwing them.
Like the PSP Go.
You're getting less with that.
If they're worried about the dollar losing more value, then they're going to say, well, we'll set the price a little higher, you know, let's err on the side of it being higher, and then, you know, if the exchange rate moves the other way, well, then that's gravy, if they think they can get away with it. And I mean, there's all sorts of arguments in different directions on this. I mean, the one thing I come back to is that in retrospect, I feel certain that they think they underpriced the Wii. I mean,
you
look at the time when it was going on eBay for ridiculous prices and, you know, no one could find one, all this stuff. They're looking at that and saying, we lost a bunch of money there.
Yeah.
And, you know, because people would have been more than willing to buy it for $299.
And right, then you just stage a price cut sooner.
Yeah.
And they did. I mean, they did underprice that system.
People for $299 earlier, and then as soon as you take the temperature and say, okay, let's bring it down, the point is, you know, you would have got more money out of those people that were buying Wii's at that time. And that's revenue that they've lost because they priced it the way they did. And I think it is possible they may look at the DS, the 3DS, in a similar fashion, that if they don't price it higher than $200, they may simply be throwing money down the drain. But it may not be that simple, because the question is, would the Wii have become this sort of, you know, phenomenon if it hadn't been as reasonably sort of priced as it was to begin with? I mean, it's a curious thing when you get these sort of momentums and craze and whatnot. You know, if it'd come out at 300, would it have generated the sort of initial buzz that then later led to this sort of ridiculous fad for people trying to buy it for silly prices? I mean, it's a really hard one to judge, I think. I think that's why they're being so coy about when it's coming out and how much it's going to cost, because they're still making up their minds. They don't know.
Yeah, I mean, you have to price it right for the early. I mean, it's interesting because the early adopters, you would think that they could care less about price. They just need it, right?
They'll pay whatever it takes, right?
Yeah, but at the same time, you kind of have to get deeper than that so you can get a critical mass going and get people talking about it and get buzz going, right? So yeah. You're right. It's very it's kind of an edge, a tightrope.
I don't think it's as simple as just this linear relationship between, you know, where you set the price and how many people are going to buy it, and then, you know, what yields the most revenue. They're going to take into account sort of more organic kind of demand dynamics.
Well, price does not equal value, right? In the eyes of the consumer.
So, I mean, one of the things as well I've always wondered about is this issue of it when it's going to come out. I mean, because I think with the 3D without glasses and all this, I mean, it's obviously going to be a hot thing whenever it comes out. But it has the potential, if they release it in the holiday season in America, to be just the, you know, one of those like crazy things that happens every so often, you know, like with toys or to some extent with the Wii and all that, you know, that takes on a life of its own. And I'm not sure whether that would happen so much if it didn't come out of the holiday.
Yeah, that will definitely happen in Christmas 2011 when it's out.
But that's the question, is if there's a delay of 9 months between when it first comes out and then that first holiday season.
No, because they'll have fix their quantity problems. And there inevitably will be production issues where it's like, okay, we don't have enough for what we want. Because I think you could argue that while they may have missed out by undercharging for the Wii, they also missed out on a lot of sales by just not having it.
By not having sufficient production.
So yeah. I think if you're targeting non-traditional gamers, they're not going to wait in line so they can reserve a system. They're not going to stock the GameStops for shipment days. They're not going to figure out what the shipment schedule for hardware is. They just want to be able to walk into a store and buy it like everything else.
Mm-hmm. But I mean, isn't it not the case? I mean, I would find it disappointing, to be honest. I mean, regardless of when it's going to come out to some extent. But, you know, that they wouldn't have planned ahead a lot better for these sorts of things.
But there's a million of them, and it didn't help them out, if you'll recall. So.
But, yeah, I mean, it's just because, obviously, DS... Yeah, took off after a while. We weren't sure how well that was going to go down. You know, 3DS, it seems like it's a lot more predictable that it could be a real sensation.
But even the DS was a little bit tricky to get a hold of when it first came out, and there was no reason.
But that was a ridiculous rush job of a lot. I mean, we all know, as we covered in 200, that was...
There was literally, and I say this to myself now, except for I had to keep a streak going, there was literally no reason to buy a DS on the first day. Period. I mean, nobody had to play RubRabbits that badly. Because that's all there was to play.
Feel the magic, baby.
Ping Pals.
Shut up, John.
Killer app.
I'm just saying, to me, considering, you know, they've been sort of riding out the DS for a long time now, if it would be better to have to launch at the holiday, if only they had the units, then my question is, why the bloody hell haven't they got the units? You know, I mean, shouldn't they have them, really? I mean, was this not anticipated?
Well, I think the other issue that they might want to keep on their radar is that they want to be able to have enough games out there that it's just, you know, dominating.
See, that's the thing. I think that's why there is a certain sort of lack of clarity about the 3DS situation. I mean, I know for a start, I mean, it's just a line, but, you know, Reggie at E3, you know, when quizzed about why don't we know when it's coming out, or, you know, particularly how much it's going to cost, it's kind of like, oh, well, you know, actually we're gauging the reaction here to some extent. It's going to feed into it, which, given the sort of gushing reaction to it, may suggest the 3DS could well be $300 or more on that basis.
I think $300 might be a point where they start to feel concerned, because they've now...
I don't think it's going to be $300. I think $250 with a pack-in is tops.
I don't think they need the pack-in. I think they could say it's $250. Deal with it.
I think $250 is. I just feel now, with, as I said, you know, I mean, joking aside, I do think, you know, the positive reception that we've had, that, you know, the putting the feelers out there is going to, you know, play into their thinking a bit, and it may well be. I know, you know, the analyst guys, you know, Wedbush Morgan and Lazard, they're saying $250, $300. But you know, I'm not really that convinced by that so much. But the Wii experience and all that. I, at one point, I would have been really shocked if it would have gone over 200. But now, looking at it, I'm not. And I think in terms of when it's the
maybe
timing,
229?
I think they're weighing a bunch of moving parts. You're weighing development, they're weighing what they can produce, and probably weighing, you know, marketing strategies.
But, I mean, they still have the primary leader in the market. Anything they put out is going to detract from their own sales, essentially.
Yeah.
And the DSi XL has actually given them a nice little boost in Japan. So the
even in North America too. I mean, not that it really needs it.
I mean, in Japan was where they were dealing with problems, but the XL has actually done nicely.
Well,
for
I mean, in Japan, it's worth mentioning they've already cut the price on the DSi, as they have in UK actually as well. Interesting.
And then you all got an XL price cut too, though, didn't you?
Yeah. It's you know, on the family of systems basically.
Yeah.
In Japan and here. So yeah, that is interesting. It seems like, you know, perhaps they're laying the groundwork there for a launch fairly soon. So I mean, I would be surprised if it doesn't come out before the end of the year in Japan.
Do you think it's going to have a worldwide launch, or do you think we're going to see it come out in Japan and then a month later?
I think it's very likely there's going to be some sort of staggering going on.
I think there will be too.
See, that's kind of where I'm the opposite. I think they're just going to blast it out maybe within the course of, except for Australia, who will get it in 2013.
Yeah.
I think everybody else is going to get it
the same day that they get Metroid Other M.
They'll get it when we get the 4DS, essentially.
One other thing I think to consider as well is I think doing the whole, like the marketing stuff is going to be another issue for them, you know, and I don't know whether there might be different timescales with which the subsidiaries are comfortable with that, you know, because they're, you know, as we've said, there's unique challenges to marketing the 3DS in terms of, you know, the need to get it in people's hands, get the word of mouth going.
Well, I mean, you can even look to see what Microsoft is doing with Kinect. I don't know if any of you guys heard about how, like, there's basically going to be mall tours with Kinect, as far as, like, I think they're showing up in Macy's and some other store, too. But basically to show off the technology and get people, like, know that it's out there and how it feels. And I think that's what the same thing they have to do with 3DS is have some sort of, you know, cross-country tour that will show people the system and be like, how fucking awesome does this look?
That is absolutely essential. But, I mean, it goes back, you know, again, another, I mean, you know, whether it's coming out before the end of the year or not, it would certainly behoove them to do that sort of thing before the end of the year, because when is there more foot traffic in malls than in the holidays?
Yeah.
But it costs a lot more to do promotions in malls during the holidays, too.
It's fucking Nintendo. Does cost really that much of an issue?
Yeah, because they're a well-run organization when it comes to managing their public relations.
Yeah, but just think, if they can get the word out there about 3DS when there's all this foot traffic in malls, I think it would be quite a good payoff and definitely a worthy risk.
And maybe that's the way that they kind of square the circle, you know, kind of have their cake and eat it in terms of they kind of take advantage of the sort of unique fever of the holiday buying season in terms of building buzz for the 3DS, but they actually bring it out afterwards, having already built that kind of momentum when they've got more product in the pipeline and they've got more software to go with it.
I think if we don't hear anything about some sort of, like, 3DS cross-country tour in North America, like, starting in September, it's not coming out until 2011.
You think there needs to be a substantial lead-in on that?
Yeah, I think there needs to be some kind of campaign that will show off the system to people.
I mean, that's one of the things you saw when they showed it on the Jimmy Fallon show. Is he's just looking? He's like, "Oh wow, this is so cool!" It's like nobody at home can even know what he's looking at.
Yeah, it kind of falls a bit flat, doesn't it?
Yeah,
you know, I mean,
but they've already discussed how they're going to deal with that, though. I mean, a lot of their advertisements are going to be in things like 3D movies that are already in 3D, or they're going to use exaggeration, like the B-reel film they had of Reggie laughing that his boss and his biggest moneymaker are about to be murdered by their own creations.
Well, we're going to close out this with just a quick another DS favorite memories email that we got in just quickly, so I just wanted to fit this in before we conclude the show. And this is from The Fleece, and he writes, "The DS discussion really made my day, because out of any type of console, I've always had a portable, regardless of where I was in the world or in my life. I can remember destroying foot soldiers on TMNT for the Game Boy, or listening to the creepy but so very cool music of Metroid 2 late at night. This goes for all versions of the Game Boy which I've owned, and the DS is really no different, except it found a way to be involved in the mystery of love. When the DSi launched, I hooked up with my present girlfriend. We both play games, and I decided to get us DSi systems to play and interact with each other. And we've gone on to play lots of games and share experiences that have added fun and geekery to our lives. Sure, without the DSi, my gal and I could still have had fun, but as far as gamers and lovers do go, you can't discredit the inclusion of Mario Kart, Metal Slug, and Personal Trainer Walking. Portables have enriched every phase of my life, and the DS is a really great system." So there it is, another case of the DS bringing people together. Apparently that's two in a row. Can anyone keep the streak going?
I've actually met The Fleece and his girlfriend. He lives, I don't know if he lives in New York or around the area, but I met him at the new Super Mario Brothers Wii launch, and I met his girlfriend as well. I assume this is the same one.
Well, if it's not, and you better hope that the girl you met isn't still around, or we've just outed The Fleece as a philanderer.
A philanderer. What are you, 70?
At which point I would say that is the end of Radio Free Nintendo Season 2, and that we'll have to all be replaced, as The Fleece will have us killed.
Well, as I say, if anyone could keep the DS love match streak going, please send those messages or any other questions, comments.
So does that mean I can write an email in?
No, your staff. Staff can write emails.
Send all those in to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. We always need plenty more letters for the show. Of course, we always appreciate it if you can find the time to rate or review us on iTunes. That's always good as well. We also, of course, have to consider our sister podcasts, Radio Trivia. And, of course, the NWR Newscast,
yes.
Which Neil is a regular.
Yeah, and our next episode might feature a new voice in the podcast land. We're working to see if that's going to happen.
Always an adventure with that, isn't it?
Yep.
So make sure you check out those podcasts. And that is going to just about wrap it up for this week. I will remind people that the retroactive number 13 discussion for Mother 3 is ongoing in the forums. So please, if you are participating, join in there, give us your thoughts. They will be used to contribute to the upcoming discussion we'll be having on a future episode of RFN. So we really need those. And I know, Neil, you've played through the game before. You're looking forward to this one.
I personally think the game's awesome. I played it about, I guess, a year and a half ago at this point, and I thought it was really, really good.
So look forward to that coming up. And for now, this week, that's the end of the episode. Thanks very much to James, John, and Neil, and we'll catch you next week. Bye-bye, everyone.
Bye.
See ya. Obviously, Sony's building something that will have some stupid feature tied into whatever the hell they want to sell at this particular moment. That will be a disaster, yeah. Like memory stick discs.
It'll be like a handheld 3D TV that'll cost like $1,500.
Yes, and they'll have commercials of Peyton Manning walking around with one on a wheelbarrow. Yes.
Yep.
Well, they're going to do what they did with the Wii. They already laid the groundwork for what to do with the system that's hard to represent.
For the first 6 months of the Wii's lifetime, not even the kiosks were playable. They were just videos because they couldn't figure out how to mount a Wii remote so it wouldn't get stolen.
Yeah, I remember going into a GameStop to test it out, and I had to give them my driver's license so they could give me a Wii remote.
So what you ended up with was you ended up with Wii visuals next to playable PS3 and 360, and it was stupid.
I remember seeing Excite Truck up against MotorStorm, and it was just like, well, one of these is a lot more fun, and one of these looks beautiful.
And one of these has much better music. Oh, wait.
Well, I certainly look forward to the next episode of Newscast, which will be coming out probably a few days after this episode of RFN comes out.
Yeah, Radio Trivia comes out this week, and it is. I'm afraid to say, I believe it is Carl on this episode.
Yes, Carl is on Radio Trivia this week.
So John's already contemplating shutting down the site for a few days while he intercepts that podcast.
Well, he's just going to tell the Drunkcast story again. I mean, he did it on Newscast, we cut it out. He did it on RFN, it got cut out. Will TYP cut it out?
Oh, yes, definitely, no question. He would not just cut it out, he would delete the entire episode.
I think in the most recent version of Carl's account of it, James is Kaiser Soze. I think at that point it's really got very far away from what actually happened.